From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, the Library of Congress opened a permanent exhibition dedicated to the late jazz composer and baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we remember Mulligan with a 1989 interview. And we'll listen back to an interview and performance featuring guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli. He's helped keep alive the dying art of rhythm guitar and the styles of the early jazz guitar masters. His new CD features him with his son, guitarist John Pizzarelli. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Michael Moore's new series, The Awful Truth, and film critic John Powers reviews Go. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, the Library of Congress added a new permanent exhibition dedicated to the late jazz composer and baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan. Mulligan died in 1996. He would have been 72 this week. The new exhibition includes photographs, music manuscripts, scores, record album covers, and his gold-plated baritone. On today's archive edition, we have a 1989 interview with Mulligan. Mulligan was featured on the landmark Miles Davis-Gil Evans collaboration, Birth of the Cool. Although Mulligan was from New York, he became identified with West Coast jazz after moving to L.A. in the early 50s, where he formed his famous pianoless quartet with Chet Baker. The group played a more temperate approach to bop that became known as cool jazz. Here's the group, recorded live in 1953. Peter Watrous of the New York Times remembered Jerry Mulligan as one of the great improvisers of post-war jazz. Watrous wrote, "In his hands, the baritone saxophone, usually a burly, stiff creature, became supple and elegant." Here's our 1989 interview. In the late 40s, you teamed up with arranger Gil Evans for what became one of the key recording sessions of modern jazz, the sessions that became known as the Birth of the Cool, mm-hmm. with Miles Davis and the Nonet. How did you and Evans first get together for these sessions?
Well, being an arranger with the band, I met the arrangers for all the other bands, and there was always a kind of a sense of camaraderie between the arrangers that's separate from the other players. And I became very close with Gil. I loved the way he wrote. That Thornhill band had a very orchestral approach because Claude Thornhill himself was a pianist whose whole approach was very Davis-y-like. He loved the French Impressionists, and he gave that kind of aura to the band, the way the things were orchestrated and the use of French horns and clarinets in the ensemble was quite unique at that time.
When you were writing for the Nonet, did you see that as a compromise between a big band and a small group?
Well, it's I suppose compromise is a word. We never thought of it as a compromise. What we were looking for was a vehicle that would give us the kind of rhythmic freedom that you have with a small group, with something of the orchestral colors that you have with the large ensemble. And what we wound up with there was a really kind of a basic cut down in size version of the Thornhill band. And having the six horns gave us a tremendous sense of ensemble.
Let's hear something from The Birth of the Cool. This is Giroux, composed and arranged by my guest baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan. The 1950s, you moved to the West Coast. What brought you there?
Well, things were pretty rough in New York at that point. There were the places to work got fewer and fewer, and it was hard to make a living here. And the big bands that I had depended on to make a living were starting to die out. You know, the economy changed, and so I left New York and went to California to look for the land of opportunity.
And what you found there was trumpeter Chet Baker. And you formed a quartet with him that ended up being the kind of seminal band that would define the sound that became known as the West Coast Sound or cool jazz. Tell me how you teamed up with Baker.
Well, when I went to California, I first started out through friends writing arrangements for Stan Kenton's band. And I used to spend a lot of time going around to jam sessions all over the Los Angeles area. And I encountered Chet a few times at sessions, and I liked very much the way he played. He had a very melodic approach, and he was a wonderful player. And so when it came time to put together something to take into a club to go to work, I finally wound up settled on this instrumentation with Chet. And so it was just a thing of proximity and opportunity, and it turned out to be the land of opportunity.
One of the things that distinguished your quartet was that it was a modern jazz group that didn't have a piano. Why didn't you have one?
Well, there were a couple of reasons for that, but the main reason was that the club we went into was a little place called The Hague in near downtown Los Angeles. When I first was playing on the off nights at this club, The main attraction in the club was Errol Garner. They had this beautiful concert grand piano on the stage. Well, the group following Errol was the trio of Red Norvo. Well, Red's instrumentation was, played the vibraphone. And he had a guitarist and a bass player. I think Charlie Mingus was with him then. And so they took this beautiful big grand piano out. And so I was going to play on the off night. They said, well, they'll bring in a little upright. I said, no, you won't. I said, to go from this beautiful grand to upright, I won't do it. So I said, I'll put together a group that doesn't need a piano. And so it allowed me to put into practice something that we'd already tried in New York, rhythm section without a piano. And it worked very well.
Well, let me play something from your quartet with Chet Baker. This is a 1953 recording. It's your composition called Line for Lions. We'll hear more of our 1989 interview with Jerry Mulligan after a break. This is Fresh Air.
¶¶
Let's get back to our 1989 interview with the late baritone saxophonist and composer Jerry Mulligan.
Well, while you were in the West Coast, you actually spent 3.5 months in a California prison on drug charges. You had been, you'd become addicted to heroin, as many of the jazz musicians of that time had become. Were you, what kind of prison were you in, and what was your life like while you were there?
Well, it wasn't very pleasant. And as far as prisons go, I suppose it wasn't very difficult, because it was, I guess, a medium security compound out in the country north of Los Angeles. And some of the people in the prison, the guards and the wardens and all that, were very nice, and some were terrible. And they had, as I suppose they usually do, they had the people who were in there for various narcotics possessions were kind of kept together, and it could have been a lot worse. And the funny thing was, as soon as I got there, it turns out that the people who were involved in the prison work of called the care and treatment, I mean, they had the big battle going between the people said the prison is for punishment, and the other people saying, well, prison is for rehabilitation. And these people are always fighting with each other to get the upper hand, you know. Well, I no more than arrived in this place, and the care and treatment people came up and said, would you write a Christmas show for us? Said, sure. Well, that created a great deal of resentment with the people who thought that I was supposed to be being punished. And I found myself having a very hard time with some of the guards who were, you know, kind of the traditional sadistic types. Huh. And so it's kind of a pulling match between one and the other. And, well, I wound up putting a little band together and writing music for them, but wound up never doing the show because an organization called Narcotics Anonymous got a hold of a good lawyer. I had been very unlucky in the choice of lawyer. He was just a stupid man. I found out later that a lot of people that he had represented used to do things like put sugar in his gas tank and various things because he was such a rotten person. And it was very bad luck to wind up with somebody. Well, anyway, this organization and friends managed to get a rehearing, and they modified my sentence to time served and let me out. It was kind of a thing right out of a movie. It was, I think, the day or two before Christmas, and they took me into the down into the city to go to the court to have this hearing. And I think that the bus or the car that I was in to go down there got stuck in traffic, so by the time we got there, the hearing was already over, and I had been released. And it must have totally stunned the other people that I was in prison with, because they said nobody gets modified on a short sentence. It was a 6-month sentence to begin with. And so that was amazing. So the day before Christmas, I was released.
I want to ask you about a story that Nat Hentoff told in a New Yorker profile of you years ago. And he told the story of how when you were arranging with the Gene Krupa band, and this was in the 1940s, you were very young, one night on the bandstand with the audience there, you started chewing out the band for being sloppy and telling Krupa that, you know, he was irresponsible for allowing that sloppiness to happen. Pretty nervy for a young musician.
Yes, but I did not tell Gene Krupa off for allowing it to happen.
Oh, okay.
But what happened was, it wasn't a night in New York. We had a long plane trip into Atlantic City, New Jersey, or someplace, and we were playing in the afternoon. And, yes, you know, it was a thing that's always kind of amazed me about myself, is that I was a terrible sideman, because I was always, you know, I kind of elected myself the conscience, the musical conscience of the band. And, you do things like that when you're young. You're idealistic and so on. But I didn't learn how to be a good sideman in a band until after I'd been a leader and realized what you really should contribute. I didn't know how to contribute to the organization in terms of attitude. And so I was kind of a bristly person in that way.
So maybe you don't have the temperament to be a sideman.
That's true.
Maybe you have to be a leader.
Well, I think that's right. There are a lot of things about being a sideman that are so far from my personality. I could never be a studio musician to play music and learn it and play it once and that's the end of it. Music is to me something that has to live every day. And when I play a piece of music that I like, I want to play it a lot. I don't want to just play it once. So, I think you're right. There's a little bit of a personality problem there to be a success playing with a band.
Well, Jerry Mulligan, I thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Jerry Mulligan recorded in 1989. He died in 1996. This week, the Library of Congress opened a new permanent exhibition dedicated to him. This Sunday, the Bravo Cable Network presents the premiere of a new series from Michael Moore. Moore is the independent filmmaker who first came to prominence with Roger and Me, a documentary blaming General Motors and its then-chairman, Roger Smith, for ruining Moore's hometown of Flint, Michigan. 10 years later, Moore is still taking aim at big corporations, but this time, says TV critic David Bianculli, his style is a little different.
What made Michael Moore so good in Roger and Me, with all his unsuccessful attempts to land an on-camera interview with GM chairman Roger Smith, was that Michael Moore, at the time, really was a nobody. He was a little guy going up against a corporate giant, David against Goliath, but with a film crew instead of a slingshot. Since then, Moore has made one more excellent documentary, Pets or Meat, a sequel to Roger and Me, and one terrific TV series. That was TV Nation, which lasted one summer on NBC and another summer on Fox. But on a show where Moore spent each week identifying and attacking the abuses of big business, the networks owned by General Electric and Rupert Murdoch weren't about to give Michael Moore too much slack. It's amazing, in retrospect, they let him onto primetime network TV in the first place. Now it's 5 years later, and Michael Moore is back with a new TV series. But this time it's on the Bravo cable network, and is co-financed by Channel 4 in England. The series is called The Awful Truth. And the awful truth about it is that this time, Michael Moore looks like he's beginning to take his own celebrity too seriously. On TV Nation, Moore didn't have a studio or an audience. He just filmed the openings and closings of each show by standing in Times Square, hiding in plain sight as a guerrilla TV host. But on The Awful Truth, he has a studio and a studio audience. When he shows his taped reports to us, that audience is seeing them too, and reacting to them, providing the show with an authentic but still annoying laugh track. Worst of all, Moore attempts to open the show with a comedy monologue. He may be a great filmmaker and a good speaker, but he's a lousy comedian. So what's good about The Awful Truth? When Moore chooses the right targets, his insistent approach still works. In Sunday's premiere, he schedules an interview with an executive at the HMO Corporation, Humana, to find out why a guy is being refused coverage for a pancreas transplant he needs to live. Moore brings the guy with him, but the executive dodges the meeting, leaving a poor public relations staffer to deal with Moore, the patient, and the film crew.
Obviously, we're interested in the health of our members and trying to improve the health of our members whenever and wherever we can. And certainly, we're committed to that.
Right, except he'll die if he doesn't get the pancreas. That's the problem.
I'm certainly not familiar with his case, and we'd be happy to look into it for you.
You would?
Sure, absolutely. Right.
Claim number 332-6449-5501. Let's go to a computer right now and look up the facts.
I'm afraid I can't do that.
Well, we'll wait here while you go research the facts.
That's not going to be possible.
Well, we'll wait until you go and get somebody to come down here.
I can't do that today because all the appropriate people aren't available at this point. So
well, we'll wait till they are available.
I'm going to have to ask you to leave now, and I'll go look at it immediately.
He has a 4-year-old daughter.
Do you have kids?
Do you have any kids? So, you ready? You ready?
Do you have daughters?
Let's work our way out this way.
When could you die?
Today. Who knows?
You could die today.
Yeah.
That's what the doctor said.
Shall we?
Shall we what?
Shall we move toward the door so that I can research Mr. Donahue's case?
As opposed to what?
What else do you need? What else do you seek? What else do you want?
Every day that goes by while you investigate the facts is a day closer to his funeral.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we won't take no for an answer.
I understand that.
I signed with Humana and all I got was this lousy t-shirt. But no pancreas.
Even with the intrusive laughter in the background, this segment works, in more ways than one. At the end of the show, Moore announces that a week later, Humana reversed its decision. The patient stands up in the audience holding his little girl, and both he and the audience goes wild. It's a giddy victory, and is the sort of thing that makes the awful truth worth watching, even with that awful monologue and laughter.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli. His latest album, Contrasts, features him performing with his son, John Pizzarelli. And film critic John Powers reviews Go. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new CD, Contrasts, teams up two great jazz guitarists, Bucky Pizzarelli and his son, John Pizzarelli. On this archive edition, we have an interview and performance with Bucky. First, let's hear a track from the new CD featuring Bucky Pizzarelli playing lead. This is Stage Fright. Thank you. Listening to Bucky Pizzarelli is like listening to a history of jazz guitar. He's played with some of the same musicians his guitar predecessors have, musicians like Benny Goodman, Joe Venuti, and Stefan Grappelli. And in the days when there was a lot of studio work for jazz musicians, he was one of the most sought-after ones, so he has quite a varied resume. He was a member of the Tonight Show Orchestra when they broadcast out of New York, and he's recorded with Dion and the Belmonts and Ray Charles. But he doesn't need to play with anyone to sound great. He's wonderful solo, as you're about to hear. Bucky Pizzarelli's 1992 Fresh Air interview and performance was first broadcast live from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York before a studio audience.
I'd like to do a number written by Ray Noble called The Very Thought of You.
Great. I should mention, your guitar is not the kind of standard guitar. It's a 7, not a 6-string guitar.
That's a 7-string guitar developed by George Van Epps, who lives in California.
So what do you do with the 7th string?
Well, it's good for accompanying. If I'm playing with another guitarist or a singer, I'm doing this. That gives me a bass. It's like a bass and a guitar playing together. Without the 7th string, it would just sound... So it gives it that low note.
That's nice, yeah. Speaking of which, you are one of the great rhythm guitar players. For our listeners who don't know what we mean when we say rhythm guitar, play a little bit of rhythm guitar and show us.
Well, rhythm guitar is the very most important thing of playing the guitar. If I advise anybody that wants to play guitar to learn how to play the chords first. That's how I learned. In the old days of... Gene Autry on the radio, he was doing... But it's very important to know the chords. It's funny, but it's important. A lot of young guitarists start playing solos, and they forget about playing chords. And I'll show you, I'll give you an example how Freddie Green, probably the greatest rhythm guitar player with the Count Basie Orchestra, played rhythm. And if you listen to any of the old Count Basie bands, the most predominant thing of the band and the sound of the band is the rhythm guitar. And he's only playing a few notes in a chord, not a full chord. He's not doing that. He's playing...
What's the hardest thing about playing rhythm guitar?
Well, getting a beat out of it. You become a drummer.
Right.
At one spot, and if you don't come down after the bass player plays the downbeat, you're playing the second and fourth beats of the bar of music. And it's that commitment. If it's a slow, the slower the song is, the harder it is, and you better be right when you come down with it.
Well, you told us a little bit about Freddie Green and the influence he had on you. Let's talk about some of the other kind of historical styles and the players who created them that have influenced you. How about Django Reinhardt, who...
Django, yes, was in a group in Paris with Stefan Grappelli, a jazz violinist, and they had a group called the Hot Club of France. And they sort of imitated the big bands in America, the swing bands, Benny Goodman's and Duke Ellington's and the Count Basie, and they tried to do the same thing just with strings. And Django was a very vibrant player, and he was handicapped. He had two fingers. His first two fingers were the only fingers that moved on the instrument.
I always find that so remarkable.
And he played sort of an acoustic sound, and later on when he appeared with Duke Ellington here in the States, he played electric. But his most famous song, I'll play one quick chorus for you, and then I'll show you how he played. This is the song he wrote. It's called Nuage. String style that he was famous for.
Yeah, one of the things that's really interesting about you is that you've played, you know, demonstrating Django Reinhardt. He played with Stefan Grappelli, so did you. Eddie Lang, the great guitarist, influenced you. He played with Joe Venuti, so did you. Charlie Christian, the great jazz guitarist, played with Benny Goodman. You eventually played with Goodman. So did you always feel like you had to really play in the styles of the guitarists who had preceded you in those groups?
Well, when I was going to high school, I used to listen to all those records. And we didn't have many records to go by, but it was mostly radio shows that we listened to, and we often caught Charlie Christian with Benny Goodman from one of the hotels here in New York,
yeah.
And the same thing, a few records of Charlie Christian that he made, Charlie's made with the Sextet, and also Django Reinhardt with Hot Club.
What does Charlie Christian do for you?
Charlie played a more swinging single string style that imitated a tenor saxophone, and he didn't play quarterly at all. He just played single notes, but he played in the style of a Lester Young playing straight eighth notes. He made a great record with Benny Goodman called Solo Flight, and he played like that.
That style a lot in your own playing?
Oh, yeah. I steal from the best.
Yeah. Where'd you steal from Eddie Lang?
Well, Eddie Lang played a chordal style. He played fill-ins behind Benny Goodman,
Joe Venuti.
No, Bing Crosby.
Oh, yeah.
And they were known, you know, whenever you heard Bing Crosby on the radio, there was always a guitar playing without the amplifier, and he was playing fill-ins. That's all you heard him noodling all through the records. And his famous record is a tune called Please. And all you hear throughout the record is Eddie Lang playing that beautiful guitar style.
And Carl Kress.
Carl Kress was teamed with another guitarist here in New York, and they were known for playing many radio shows. They did like 30 shows a week, not too far from here, and they played practically every show that was to be played in New York City.
Is there a particular style of his?
Yes, they had a great style, and they just for laughs, they would get together and go to a studio and make records. And the nice thing about Carl Kress was that he was one of the most musical of all the guitarists because they played romantic music. They listened to classical music constantly, and then it came out in their jazz, and they would also play humorous music, frisky music, and they would play swing, and they would do everything together, and they had some kooky little pieces that they played. Some were called Chicken a la Swing. One was called, it went like... you know, little razzmatazz kind of songs like that. But then he also wrote some nice pieces, one called Love Song. That's called Love Song. Then he did a kooky one called Peg Leg Shuffle.
We'll hear more of Bucky Pizzarelli's 1992 interview and performance after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1992 performance and interview with guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli. It was first broadcast live from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York.
Bucky Pizzarelli is joining us live with his guitar. And Bucky, you've demonstrated for us like different historical styles that you've learned over the years. Let's put it all together. Play something your own. You know, the composition isn't your own, but the style is. And I think we'll hear maybe a lot of the things that you've been pointing out in the past few minutes.
Okay, I'd like to do Satin Doll. Thank you.
I guess that about sums it up. Yeah. That's wonderful. You know, you've had such an interesting career, just playing with all the jazz musicians, doing all the studio work. I mean, I can't believe you were on sessions with Dion and the Belmonts. Is that were you into the music, or was it just a gig?
No, I learned a lot from a lot of those people. You know, because in those days, mostly everybody was trying to play jazz gigs or play with dance bands, and dance bands were just fading then, and everybody was migrating back to New York. And if you owned a guitar, they put you on a rock and roll date. You know, and a lot of people don't know that. Some of the best jazz guitar players are on the best rock and roll dates.
Yeah, Barney Kessel's on a lot of them,
oh, everybody.
Too. Yeah,
George Barnes, Tony Mottola, and Mundell Lowe. We all did sessions every day, and we never had the kind of guitars that the kids are buying today to play those sessions. We had all jazz guitars.
You know, I put on Teenager in Love to see if I could hear you, and I heard what sounded like a banjo.
Oh, here we go. Yeah, that's it. But all those dates were more or less faked. We would have three or four guitar players, and one would go. Another guy would go.
Do you miss those days when there was a lot of studio work? Because it isn't like that anymore.
No, well, I didn't like it because it got the music, you know, we only played three chords. You know, you do that all year, drive right. up the walls.
Oh, gosh. In the 2 seconds we have left, how'd you get the nickname Bucky? Who gave it to you?
Oh, my father gave me that name. Uh-huh. He went to Texas when he was young, and when he came back, he had to name somebody after a cowboy, I guess.
And you were the one. All right. Well, this has been a great pleasure. Just really fun. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's good to do live radio.
Yeah, isn't it great? Yeah. The great jazz guitarist, Bucky Pizzarelli.
Bucky Pizzarelli recorded in 1992 at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. Bucky Pizzarelli is on tour. In the next few weeks, he'll perform in Palm Beach, New York City, and Atlanta. His new album, with his son, guitarist John Pizzarelli, is called Contrasts. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new movie, Go. This is Fresh Air. Go is a hip new ensemble comedy that shows off a string of the rising young actors in Hollywood. Go is directed by Doug Liman, whose debut film was Swingers. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
A few days ago, my normally sensible producer on this show was grumbling about the Clint Eastwood movie that I praised a while back. she found it slow. Well, she won't have that problem with Go, a frantic new comedy. It begins in an L.A. supermarket, where a sullen cashier named Rana, played by Sarah Polley, frets about rent money. Her crazy British co-worker Simon is hoping she'll take his shift, and two beaming TV actors, played by Scott Wolf and Jay Moore, try to wheedle her into scoring them some ecstasy. From the moment these characters leave the store, the movie roars to life, telling three separate tales of the underground. In the first one, Rana and her skeptical friend Claire, played by Katie Holmes from Dawson's Creek, get involved in a makeshift drug deal that boomerangs disastrously. The second story happens in Vegas, where the crazy Brit and his friend Marcus, that's Taye Diggs, plunge into a madhouse of car theft and gunplay. The third brings us back to L.A., where the two TV actors have to deal with a kinky-seeming cop and a lifeless body. The movie has the jolting giddiness of a bumper car ride. And if Quentin Tarantino had never been born, I'd probably be raving up its bold three-part structure. As it is, Go could probably be retitled Pulp Fiction Jr., since its 20-something cast dashes through all the familiar landmarks of Tarantinoville. This is a movie brimming with pop references, as when the nice girl Claire talks about life with a drug dealer, played by Timothy Oliphant.
What do you have against the family circus?
Okay. You sit down and read your paper, and you're enjoying your entire two-page comic spread, right? And then there's the family circus, bottom right-hand corner, just waiting to suck. And that's the last thing you read, so it spoils everything you read before.
You could just not read it.
I hate it, yet I'm uncontrollably drawn to it.
Tarantino began as an actor, and his movies are filled with juicy bits of business for the performers. So is Go, which is obviously designed to showcase its hot young actors. And they deliver. As Simon, Desmond Askew is a hoot as one of those crazy L.A. Brits who sees America as a big ride. Scott Wolf and Jay Moore are slyly funny as actors with something to hide, and handsome Taye Diggs reaffirms the charisma he first flashed in How Stella Got Her Groove Back. The movie's great breakthrough, though, is the Canadian Sarah Polley, last seen in The Sweet Hereafter, whose fierce, intelligent energy makes Rana's story easily the most engrossing of the three. At first glance, Polley looks eerily like Uma Thurman, but she's actually much smaller in stature and much larger in talent. Go was directed and shot by Doug Liman, who has an obvious eye for cultural touchstones. His first movie, Swingers, helped launch the annoying vogue of Sinatra-ized cocktail culture. But Liman's uncanny feel for the zeitgeist shouldn't hide the fact that he's a much more talented filmmaker than he initially appeared. This is sharper work than Swingers, tighter, punchier, better acted, and Liman never lets the energy level falter, which is surely the point of a picture called Go. Sheer velocity is also the essence of the hottest movie in the country, The Matrix, which is essentially a hip version of Star Wars for those weaned on comic books, Japanese animation, and cyberpunk novels like Neuromancer. While the movie has its dull stretches, it's a huge hit because it contains some of the coolest scenes ever put on film. You can hear the audience giggle with delight during the high-tech kung fu fights, where characters bend back quickly enough to dodge bullets, or literally fly in the air to slug it out. These scenes bring together the best of Hong Kong's stunt work and Hollywood's digitalized know-how. Although it's shot through with nifty ideas cribbed from Buddhism, Blade Runner, and Joseph Campbell, The Matrix doesn't actually have a lot on its mind. But as with Go, deep meaning is beside the point. 90 years ago, the futurist Tommaso Marinetti wrote that a new beauty has been added to the splendor of the world, the beauty of speed. And that's the beauty you can find in Matrix and Go, which are aimed at an audience attuned to the rhythms of the new millennium. They start fast, then go even faster.
Joan Powers is film critic for Vogue and Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive show was produced by Roberta Shurrock with Kathy Wolf. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture, and from Bantam Books,
publishers of Robert Thurman's book, Circling the Sacred Mountain, A Spiritual Adventure Through the Himalayas, written with Tad Wise. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worry on the doorstep.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember lyricist Dorothy Fields with singer Rebecca Kilgore and pianist Dave Frischberg. Fields' songs include On the Sunny Side of the Street, I Can't Give You Anything But Love, I'm in the Mood for Love, and The Way You Look Tonight. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
On the sunny side of the street, I...